Councilman Arnold, Washington Public Affairs, Monday, January 1, 1999, 2 o'clock p.m. here in the meeting. Public hearing and possible work session on HB 3154, work session on SB 404A, SB 5358, SB 950, SB 937, SB 229, HB 2670.
Call this meeting of the House Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs Committee to order. The number of bills on our agenda today is Senate Bill 404. If anyone is here for that, the amendments are not ready yet, I'm told, so we will have to put it off to tomorrow. And we will begin meeting from 8 to 10 in the morning, as well as from 2 till whenever we get done in the evening and the afternoon. This is Chair Thurman Lowe. We may have to end up for a work session only tomorrow. That's going to start a public notice on public hearing. So we cannot go to any public hearings until Wednesday morning. Thank you. Okay. So we will start off the agenda today with at the top to accommodate my esteemed colleagues. And we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 3164. And gentlemen, I appreciate you coming. We do have the actual amendments to the bill before us. And give us a rundown of the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3154 would require that a majority of voters in both the city and the territory proposed to be annexed to approve an annexation plan under which a city may annex territory within an urban growth boundary. Under current law, the area, city and the area to be annexed vote, and it's a majority of the entire area. This would require a separate majority. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We have the actual amendments here also. Yes, Mr. Westland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me jump in and go first here, and then if I could, let me excuse myself, and I will relieve Representative Mannix, who is currently chairing my committee, and getting back here so you're at full complement. But just let me briefly state what this bill is. I think it ends a highly unfair and very undemocratic practice we have currently allowed in our state. And, you know, way back in 1849, Tocqueville wrote about the tyranny of the majority, and that's exactly what we have here. We have a majority of people being able to affect the will, the rights, and the wishes of a minority through some recent legislation that was enacted, I believe, in 95, that creates a super, I shouldn't say super, but a special elections district. In this case, specifically, I'm referring to the city of Bend, where the city residents numbered 30,000 were allowed to incorporate the entire urban reserve area, whose residents totaled 11,000. And functionally how this was done, and it was above board, they were acting within the law, they were perfectly within their statutory rights, and they conducted a special election, and the 30,000 people of the incorporated area city of Bend overwhelmed the 11,000 people that lived in the urban reserve, many of whom, you know, lived in that urban reserve prior to it being inside the urban growth boundary, but outside the city limits. It's a very rough analysis and analogy of what happened. I don't think that's very fair. I don't think any of my colleagues think that's particularly fair. Many people see this bill that Representative Schrader and myself have proposed as anti-growth. Nothing could be further from the truth. You know, of the 24 municipalities in this state that allow the double majority rule, that have municipal ordinances requiring the double majority rule, 80%, and I'm not exactly sure of that statistic, but it's 75 to 80% of their annexations have passed successfully. So what this bill does is, for the future, require that for an area to be annexed, the annexing area and the area, the annexing area, i.e. the city, and the area to be annexed must pass by a majority in two separate elections. Now, you're going to hear a little bit later on about some amendments that we have to this bill. And I just like to say I encourage those. I support those fully.
The Dash 1 Amendments.
The Dash 1 Amendments. And unless there's any questions for me, I'd like to excuse this.
Is this Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to keep him here as long as possible because he's the right balance on this committee.
I appreciate your desire to maintain that, but he does have some important work to do for us down in Ways and Means. Lieutenant Gardner?
Just one quick question, Representative. You were talking about the area being annexed outside of Bend, being overwhelmed by the group inside of Bend. What, can you give me a rough percentage number of what the vote was on the area outside being annexed?
Well, inside the city limits of which sold about approximately 30,000 people, the vote was about 70% for, 30% against. And of the 11,000 people that live outside the city limits but live inside the urban growth boundaries, it was about 70% against, 30% for.
Okay.
Those are rough numbers I'm recalling from the top of my head, but while they may be a point or two off in accuracy, their spirit is certainly correct.
Okay. Thank you.
And I will go and try and retrieve your other committee members.
This is Manning. Sitting down.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Mr. Schrader.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Representative Kurt Schrader from House District 23. Very interested in House Bill 3154, and I come at it from a different reason. I don't live in the Bend area, and that issue is not the reason I brought forward this bill with a good representative from Central Oregon. And I believe this whole thing is a result of an oversight. The Senate Bill 122 process from 95 is what created this statute upon which the Bend area voted on this annexation. And it basically, I'll read it quickly to you guys. The statute right now, you probably know, says if the governing body of the city finds a majority of the votes cast in the territory and the city favor the annexation plan, then the governing body shall proclaim the adoption of the annexation plan. And I would submit to you guys that the word "and" in there is fairly loose. And I don't think it was ever envisioned that one group, a vastly larger group, would overpower a smaller group. This is just pretty basic language you write in when you're talking about this sort of thing. Okay, you're going to have a vote, an each side will vote, and the majority of the city want it, the majority of the people outside the city want it, then sure, that goes through. But apparently that's not the way this has been interpreted. This has been interpreted by legal eagles and powers that be that you actually have to have you have one big happy family election that encompasses the entire area. And I don't think that was the original intent. Why do I think that? Well, last session we also had a bill, Senate Bill 947. And that did away with the Metropolitan Boundary, Portland Metropolitan Boundary Commission. In the course of those hearings, one of my major concerns was, all right, we get rid of the Portland Metropolitan Boundary Commission, but does that mean Metro then gets to set the agenda about who gets annexed, who doesn't get annexed? So we had a lot of debate on this in committee. And I was assured by many of the people behind me in this room that represent special districts, represent cities, represent counties, that, well, no, this is not about annexation, Kirk. This is just about the Boundary Commission, review of local jurisdictions' decisions. And that the only way no one specifically stated no one could be annexed against their will. There's a set process that you go through if you're a city. There's a set process you go through, in other special district areas. And in no case was someone to be annexed against their will. They could either bring forward their parcels and say, yes, I want to become part of the city, I want to develop my property, and that would happen, or it'd be done on the simple, two-thirds majority, either landowners or citizens want to go ahead and therefore annex a larger district. But in no case was it envisioned that one whole group could be outvoted by another. Basically, they're being annexed against their will. It's a very basic tenet of democracy and basic freedom. So it's real straightforward. So this amendment, or this bill, the bill itself basically makes it very clear that, hey, yes, you know, if we want to go through this Senate Bill 122 process, and the governing body of the city thinks that, hey, it's a good idea to work with this special district outside of the city, you know, for fire protection or whatever, they can come together on this, that it's in their interest to form a cohesive unit, then they would put this before their respective electors. The city would put it before theirs, and the special district would put it before theirs, and they would vote, and if a majority of both say yes, then it happens. If a majority of only one says yes, it will not happen. I think the case of Bend is illustrative, and the 3-1 vote in the city said, yeah, sure, let's bring in some more tax base and cut our taxes, and the people outside voted 3-1 against the idea, saying, whoa, we don't have to pay those city taxes, please, we like our nice little unincorporated life the way it is. And they were completely overwhelmed and outvoted. I don't think that's the sort of message this legislation wants to send forward. So we brought this little bill forward for you to consider.
Thank you, Mr. Schrader. I do have a question for you. I do believe there is a matter of fairness here. And on a larger scale in our state, we do things very much like the annexation process as it currently is. A number of issues have gone to ballot in the state of Oregon through the initiative process that are voted on and supported in the urban and metropolitan areas and go down overwhelmingly in the rural areas, yet they still pass. I hope that, I think the Cougar and Bear initiative was one based on a lot of misinformation from a lot of people. And I hope that we can someday find a way to address that basic fairness issue on a larger scale as it relates to the initiative process in Oregon.
Well, I think that you raise a very, very good point. And unfortunately, as we get into a situation where there isn't a rural and there isn't urban Oregon, that points up some of the dichotomy between the two groups as far as the issues go. Certainly, these are statewide substantive issues. I would say that this particular issue is even more heightened because once this happens, you no longer are a separate identity. You no longer have the ability to vote differently than anyone else. You are part of that jurisdiction or part of that city. It basically takes away your rights of self-determination completely and wholly, which I think is a real
thing. At least as it relates to that area.
Yeah.
Annexation or not annex.
Yeah, and then what happens is you all of a sudden have to higher taxes instantaneously, Mr. Chair. And I think that's really unfair. You may have to support certain amenities that you're not interested in at this point in time. And I'm a big one for self-determination, encouraging citizens to participate. And what incentive is there for someone in the metropolitan area that lives outside the Portland metropolitan area when they know that at any time Portland can reach out in an agreement, intergovernmental agreement with a small governing body, and say, I think we had a speech on the floor of the House today where a good representative from Myra said, well, you know, the governing body doesn't always represent the will of the people necessarily. That's a fairly decent point. And you get into this idea, you get into where, geez, they're only looking at services and taxes and this and that. What about the average person? What's he thinking? And he would be at the behest of the governing body of that special jurisdiction, says, yeah, geez, I really think this is a great idea. I want some new fire engines out there in my in my fire service district, and the city says, well, yeah, you know, it would really be good. We could easily help you. You know, we'll take your fire district in, and we'll supply you with some water and stuff. And what happens is there's a huge, huge inequity there. The people are left out in the cold from what seems, you know, there's more to life than just the fire engines and the fire district. We have other concerns, other reasons we don't want to be part of that particular system. Other taxes they don't want to pay, maybe on a septic, they see no reason for the sewer system. They've got a well, they don't want it still on the water system. So there's a lot of problems, a lot of problems.
Mr. Devin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What do you do about let me give you a couple of circumstances. The Boundary Commission, when it was listed, used to approve boundary amendments, doing it in a very skillful way, so to speak. They would get rid of their opposition to the changes by creating islands. So in a lot of cities, you will see little tiny islands all over the place that people were left out of annexation. Those people receive the same library services normally as people inside the city. They get the same, quite honestly, because of mutual assistance agreements, they get the same fire sometimes, and they get the same police, but they don't pay. Now, if you left those islands out there permanently, the chances that any of those people might vote to be annexed anytime in the future, and some of them are as few as maybe a half dozen people. How would you address it if this bill is addressed? And then there's a second issue. I don't know how I'll vote on this bill. I know it's going to go into the Ways and Means Committee, which I consider it's the undertaker of all bills. in the metropolitan area also, you have clear examples of areas that are urban and are cities, except where they are just not within a city. And you run into the issue that cities that will counties start to provide urban levels of services because they need to. And so they set up special districts. Some of them set up at the county level to start to serve those needs. And so an area that ultimately probably should have been a city, maybe it shouldn't have been in a new adjacent city that people don't want to go into, but for all practical purposes, it's a city. How do you deal with those issues given this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin. Starting backwards, forwards, The last question, I don't think has to do with anything with have to be incorporated or not. These unincorporated areas still pay for the services that are going out to the area, so it's not a question of you have to become part of the city to get them or not. You're paying for whatever urban level services are occurring in that unincorporated area. You could argue, and I would strongly agree, that it's probably not a good idea for counties to be in the business of running urban level services. I'd also disagree, though, that it's their duty to extend those services. I would say that incorporation is indeed a route to go, and there's a bill that passed the House and is going to the Senate floor that I sponsor to encourage incorporation, which I think is a logical way for people to have their handle on who they want to be if they want to seek urban level services. To the island issue, I'd agree that's not good management. That's not the way it should be. I don't think that by getting rid of the Portland Metropolitan Boundary Commission, hopefully won't have this sort of situation. I'd also point out that those five or six people that might be islanded by the urban level services with a tremendous increase in land prices at this point in time, there's strong incentive for them to go ahead and then to annex on their own by the current rules exclusive of this particular Senate Bill 122 process, and that there's tremendous advantage for them. Yeah, sure, they can't increase the value of their property until they are annexed by a city. They are not allowed, to develop those urban level services, I think, in the current land use laws. So I think there's tremendous incentives for them to get past that process. And I think it's another reason why we don't need the Portland Metropolitan Boundary Commission. That was a good aspect of the bill. But a side effect that is bad is that it does allow for huge areas, and we've seen a tremendous example of this, unfortunately, huge areas to be annexed well beyond, way beyond the urban growth boundary of an existing jurisdiction. And I think that poses great land use problems, frankly, with agricultural lands. I'd hate to see it happen in Washington County. I would hate to see that happen in Clackamas County, where we have a tremendous number of urbanized lands already. We do not need to have this sort of process occur.
Okay. Mr. Edwards.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Schrader. I have a couple of questions. You just in the bill, could you define on line 7 votes cast in the territory? what's the definition of a territory?
I'll be honest, Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I'm not sure I can exactly give a definition. I assume that's in the statute. I think they're talking about the land outside the city, territory that's aimed to be incorporated.
Yes. And I heard your testimony. The Legislative Council obviously they drafted this, so they also concur with the interpretation of, well, let's put it this way, the law needs to be clarified because it, at least as you described, you feel that the legislature has made some record about the majority, what they're talking about here. However, this would bring clarity to the statute. Is that what you're looking for?
That's what I'm asking for. I did not ask LC whether or not they interpreted this. I explained to them my concerns, what happened to them, and said, hey, how can we make this more clear that it is, you know, separate votes by the people in the city and then the people outside the city, both of them having to cast a majority before the annexation would occur.
This is always a very contentious area, annexation. And being from Portland, obviously, I'd probably wear a black hat, I suppose, in your mind. But I guess I'm trying to figure out, you raised some interesting points policy-wise, but are we really, I guess the fundamental question is, why do we annex? I mean, I think you had a rationale. Again, when I walked in my district, it wasn't that long ago, Portland had annexed large part of Multnomah County east of 82nd. When I walked out there, they had just gotten sewer lines, which to me just struck me as amazing. You know, one of the leading cities in this country, quite frankly, you're just putting in a sewer line. Now, maybe there's some federal laws that are driving a lot of this as well. This whole area I'm not that familiar with, but you do. If I hear your tone and your interest, but I guess I'm trying to find out, maybe somebody else will testify, that there is a really valid reason why we annex, and perhaps there does need to be clarification in the law. But I always find when we talk about annexation, there's always sort of an us and them. And I'm not convinced that's in the long-term interest of the state. I mean, there may be some land use issues that you're raising that are valid, but I guess I see a quality of life, at least in my personal experience going out in my district. There were some things that I would argue seem pretty common sense, but there's still hard feelings about how we've annexed in the past. So.
Make a comment, Mr. Chair, after that comes on, to kind of get at what Representative Edwards was talking about. We had a lot of discussion, and again, my interest goes back to last session, in Senate Bill 947, trying to make it abundantly clear that annexation is indeed the way to provide urban-level services, just as Representative Devlin's concerns. Currently in the metropolitan area, regardless of the urban reserves that are set up, regardless of the future thoughts about what areas should become urbanized, I was assured in this process, in this discussion last session, and I think the intent of the original people that wrote the Senate Bill 122, was that this would only occur at the time that a city nearby was willing and able to annex these areas. The Portland metropolitan area, as you know, requires that they have a plan in place and that a city is willing to annex that territory. And I think that's a very appropriate way to go, and that's what I'm trying to stay with, annexing huge areas of land without any plan, which is what happened in the Bend situation, is not good public policy. There is no transportation plan in place. There is no sewer plan. There is no water plan to provide for all those residences. And I'd ask, I think it makes perfect sense, you have to put the plan or the process before the annexation rather than the other way around. That way, the jurisdiction can plan for the future rather than just have things happen kind of out of the clear blue sky, which is not good public policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Tim Knopf, State Representative from District 54. I didn't just want to tell you why I'm here. I wanted to show you why I'm here. This is my mail that I've received on this annexation issue, this session. More mail than I've received on any other issue, probably 200 to 300 letters, emails, phone calls, and faxes. And that's why I'm here. I'm a City of Bend resident, and I voted against the annexation, and the reason I did is out of a fairness issue. For me, I could not see why folks who already have police protection through the county sheriff,
already have, many of them have their own roads that they pay to have serviced. They have their own water. They're either on septic or they have their own sewer systems. Why they would want to pay additional taxes for services that they already have, and yet they receive essentially no new benefit. And the conclusion I came to is that if I was outside the city, I don't know that I would be wanting to raise my taxes when I receive no benefit. Maybe a promise of a benefit in the future, but at this particular time, there really is no incentive for those folks to vote for annexation, and overwhelmingly, they voted against annexation for the reasons I mentioned. So really, it comes down to when the deck is stacked against you by almost 3 or 4 to 1, is it fair to assume that this is a fair and just election, or, as I believe the intent was in the 1995 legislation, that both would have to vote in order, in a positive manner, the territory plus the city, which was annexed, in order for the annexation to take place. And I talked to two legislators who were there in 95, and one of them believed that, in fact, he did have to have both, vote in the majority, and the other one was unclear as to what they had voted on in 1995, and I understand that, since it's been about 4 years since that happened. So I'm really here to represent constituents who are not very happy, who feel like they've been taxed without being represented. And I have four gentlemen who are here today who can put a real face on this particular issue. And they're Marshall Brisbane, Bob Bates, Vince Lepore, and Milton Hunt from BAND. And I would be happy to take questions and introduce those gentlemen. And a good representative from Central Oregon just gave me the vote totals, which we've been looking for. 78% of the folks who were annexed, that were outside the city, 78% voted against annexation. 74% of the city voted for it. So you can see that there was clearly a difference of opinion on this issue. And I'm not against annexation. I think most of the people who are in the urban growth boundary realize at some point that they would be annexed. But I think they believed that they would be annexed at a point where it was beneficial to both, and there was either a need for services or there was a mutual need that they had together, and that they could be annexed at that time. However, I think this was done in large part for the tax dollars that many folks saw outside the urban growth boundary that they could bring into the city, and therefore latch onto those. And so I just really want to encourage you to support House Bill 3154 and the amendment, which would basically say that BAND, as it was intended, I believe in the 1995 legislation, would need to have another vote of both the territory of the annex and the city in order to make it an annexation that works for everybody. I'd be happy to take your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Starr.
Thank you. The amendment, would that affect any other jurisdictions besides BAND?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, I'm not aware of any other jurisdiction who's had an annexation vote, and so I believe that it applies only to the BAND annexation. I think they're the first. We're going to have to deal with this issue in the legislature. There's no question, because as many other legislative districts will have cities go out and try to grab residents that are near them, I think you'll run into the same situation that I have, that you have some very unhappy people who are very passionate on their side, and I think you'll want to address this, but I think we really need to look at it now, and I think we can look at the financial ramifications in the Ways and Means Committee, but it's just a policy issue. I think we need to look at this as an issue of fairness.
I guess I'm still struggling with who interpreted the election, then. I mean, you can read this language, and I'm not a lawyer, in my opinion, either way. Did the city?
City attorney did, and the folks who were opposed to the annexation, I know, went out and got a legal opinion, and they basically said that it's going to need to be clarified in the legislature, because it's, you could in fact sue, and you could go through all the legal hassles, and it could take a year or two to be decided, and they said that it would be very expensive for those residents, and many of whom are low-income folks, and they're not going to be able to afford to fork out a bunch of money for some attorneys to try to get an opinion that would probably ultimately be appealed through our court system and take years to decide. So they were asking us as their representatives to find a legislative clarification for this.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you hearing the bill today, and we hope for your positive consideration.
Your opinion is less than there's requested just to move the bill down the way it means, as I'm sure you understand already. I will only have one person sign up in opposition to this bill, so I'll let you go next. Bill Fell.
Mm-hmm.
You're out of the room.
Lost your chance.
Lost your chance, you may have. We have a number of you who have traveled a ways to be here today.
To have another vote of both the territory of the annexed and the city in order to make it an annexation that works for everybody. I'd be happy to take your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Starr.
Thank you. The amendment, would that affect any other jurisdictions you said then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, I'm not aware of any other jurisdiction who's had an annexation vote, and so I believe that it applies only to the Bend annexation. I think they're the first. We're going to have to deal with this issue in the legislature. There's no question. Because as many other legislative districts will have cities go out and try to grab residents that are near them, I think you'll run into the same situation that I have, that you have some very unhappy people who are very passionate on their side. And I think you'll want to address this. But I think we really need to look at it now, and I think we can look at the financial ramifications in the Ways and Means Committee, but it's just a policy issue. I think we need to look at this as an issue of fairness.
Okay. I guess I'm still struggling with who interpreted the election, and then, I mean, you can read this language, and right, I mean, I'm not aware of my opinion either way. Did the city?
City attorney did, and the folks who were opposed to the annexation, I know, legal hassles, and it could take a year or two to be decided. And they said it would be very expensive for those residents. Many of them are low-income folks, and they're not going to be able to afford to fork out a bunch of money for some attorneys to try to get an opinion that would probably ultimately be appealed to our court system and take years to decide. So they were asking us as their representatives to find a legislative clarification for it. Thank you very much. We appreciate you hearing the bill today, and we hope for your positive consideration.
Your opinion is less than the expression of the opinion, which means that there's not a way to make a decision. I'm sure you understand already. I only have one person sign up in opposition to this bill. I'll let you go next. Bill Fell. Mm-hmm. You're out of the room. Lost the chance. You may have it. We have a number of you who have traveled away to be here today. We wanted to testify in support of the bill. Marshall Griswold and Walter Bates. Are you here? Why don't you gentlemen come forward? And then we'll have Vincent McCore and Milton Hunt. Okay. And as you have, I know you're here to testify in support of the bill. If you have written testimony, you can provide that to us. That would be appreciated. We do intend to move the bill down the way it means today. And if you want to repeat things that have already been said, it may be beneficial just to let me know that, let us know that you do support comments that were made by previous speakers. That would help us a bunch. Thank you. Introduce yourself to the record.
Yeah, my name is Marshall Griswold.
I'm a resident of the city of Downs in the Urban Growth Boundary. I represent a group of people called the Neighbors Against Forced Annexation. And we represent the 11,000 people in the Urban Growth Boundary, as well as many of the people in the city who were opposed to the methodology involved in Senate Bill 122 annexation. Let me give you just a little bit of background information. Let me start everything by saying that we don't consider 3154 aimed at preventing annexation. Instead, it's designed to give those impacted by an Urban Growth Boundary annexation a voice in the decision to annex. A voice they effectively lack, or we effectively lack, under the existing language of ORS 195 or Senate Bill 122. 3154 would simply amend ORS 195 or Senate Bill 122 to require majorities in both the city and the targeted area separately to approve an ORS 195 annexation plan. It would restore fairness to a otherwise reasonable statute of Senate Bill 122. And specifically in the city of Barron, Barron became the first Oregon city to pass an SB 123 annexation, which allows municipalities to annex its entire urban growth boundary in one fell swoop. In this case, 11 square miles and 11,000 people. Pretty big bite to take on. Our research indicates that the Senate Bill 122 was a stealth bill passed in the closing session of the legislature in 1993. Its intent is not clear. But what we were able to find out is that there was no testimony or input on the bill by any home or land owner, those directly affected by the bill. Its requirements are that in order to proceed with a full-scale urban growth boundary annexation, all local governments, special districts, and service providers must enter into service, urban service agreements and intergovernmental agreements to provide for an orderly urbanization of the annexed territory. This action is to be coordinated by the county. The kicker is that Senate Bill 122 called for a combined vote of the city and the targeted area to approve the annexation plan, or at least this is how it was interpreted by the city. In Bend, with a population of actually 34,000 at the time of the election, it means that the residents of the urban growth boundary were outnumbered by a ratio of 3-1. The outcome under such rules is obvious, as it was in the November election, where over 70% of the city residents voted in favor of annexation and over 70% of the urban growth boundary residents voted against annexation. The final tally was 9,564 from the city and 6,700 opposed. Neighbors Against Forced Annexation views forced annexation as a statewide issue that's not unique to Kansas. It occurred there first and therefore set a precedent that has significant impact on all Oregon residents subject to annexation under SB 122. No other city in the state has successfully completed an annexation process under the provisions of Senate Bill 122 because of its blatant unfairness. Springfield considered it in 1995, but was convinced otherwise by a petition with 3,000 signatures. Sister recently tabled a proposal to annex their entire urban growth boundary. Mayor Steve Wilson pointed to Ben's recent experience. He said, the 10,000 or 11,000 residents in the urban growth boundary were outvoted by the city residents, a scenario he wants to avoid. He further stated, it's much easier to annex bare ground. And further, once again stated, once hundreds of residents are there, why would they vote to pay higher taxes when they've already got what they want? And in the case of Dan, many of the areas involved in this particular annexation have their own water system, their own sewer system, their own road system, and they get nothing. Absolutely nothing. Except higher taxes. Senate Bill 122 mandates a process that promotes unequal treatment and is therefore considered unconstitutional. It allows a process that discourages voting by urban growth boundary residents because their vote is meaningless in view of the overwhelming city majority. The process strips away the dignity of each urban growth boundary voter because their vote is undervalued by the nature of the single majority.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, are we in work session?
We are in work session, Devlin.
Yes. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I move the Dash 4 amendment.
It's always a motion before us to move the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 950. Is there any discussion?
There's an objection.
There's an objection. Please call the roll.
No.
No.
Representative Gardner? Aye. Representative Gardner? Aye. Representative Gardner? Excuse. Representative Gardner? Aye. Chair Sinner? Aye. And the bill goes once again. We need to move the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I move House 950 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
It's always a motion for it to move Senate Bill 950 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Breyer.
Same discussion.
Delay the week. please call the roll.
Aye.
Aye. And the bill goes once again to the floor of the due pass recommendation. And again, if it appears, he will be the carrier and will close the work session on Senate Bill 950. We have Senate Bill 229, open a work session on Senate Bill 229. And I believe we have Steve Walters from the Logan Racing Commission here to visit with us voluntarily on the bill. Can you give us your perspective on the bill, if you would?
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Steve Walters. I am the chair of the Oregon Racing Commission. This is a bill that the Racing Commission proposed and sponsored. It has the support of all of the affected interests of the racing industry. The point of the bill is to give the Racing Commission statutory power to more thoroughly regulate simulcasting in the state of Oregon. And simulcasting is a process by which races from other states, in fact, for example, in California, Kentucky, other parts of the country, are essentially televised into the state of Oregon. People in the state of Oregon may bet on those races through the racetrack here in Oregon, and it's an important source of revenue for racing interest in Oregon. Senate Bill 229 does several things. One of the things that it does is requires a minimum number of live races in order to qualify for out-of-state simulcasting. That is designed to ensure that race tracks do not run simply token race meets in order to have the opportunity to present wagering on races in another state. The bill also gives the Racing Commission the authority, which it does not have now, to authorize what we call breed-to-breed simulcasting, and that is to allow the greyhound track to simulcast greyhounds on a year-round basis and allow horse tracks to simulcast horse racing on a year-round basis. And just so we're clear, this does not authorize an increased level of simulcasting. It simply would be a different way to divide up the simulcasting rights that currently exist, and there are operational and legal reasons why the tracks might prefer to do that. The bill would require their consent before we could implement that. The bill also allows the Racing Commission to license the off-track sites in the state of Oregon. Currently, we do not license the off-track betting facilities. They are they contract with a racetrack, they are approved by the Racing Commission, but we do not have licensing authority. This would increase our ability to regulate the off-track sites and increase our ability to supervise their operations. The bill also would lift the 20 off-track site cap that is currently on part of Oregon law. The sole reason for that provision is in the event we go to breed-to-breed simulcasting, it might be necessary to have some off-track sites dedicated to greyhound simulcasting, some dedicated to horse simulcasting. Again, in the view of the Racing Commission, this is a very minor and technical part of this bill. It would not increase the level of wagering in Oregon at all. Unfortunately, when the bill was debated in the Senate, there was, I think, a misunderstanding at that point. There was certainly an editorial in the Oregonian that represented, we think, a serious misunderstanding of the intent of lifting the cap on off-track sites. But in order to make very clear to this committee and to the House of Representatives, the Racing Commission last Friday passed a resolution to clarify the situation and to make clear that if we did go to breed-to-breed simulcasting, we would authorize no more than 25 off-track sites without first reporting to the governor and to the legislature. And plainly, if we were told by members of the legislature that they thought that was an improper expansion of gambling, we would listen to them and we wouldn't expand the number. But we wanted to make crystal clear that this is not an attempt to somehow throw open the floodgates to additional wagering in the state of Oregon. It is a bill designed to regulate the simulcasting more closely and to give the Racing Commission the discretionary authority that needs to carry out those responsibilities. Once again, it is sponsored by the Racing Commission and has the full support of our interests in the racing community.
Great. Mr. Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your permission is carried with the pleasure of the government, don't you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, we do not serve at his pleasure. We are appointed to four-year terms. We can be removed for cause after a public hearing. But we are not at the pleasure of the government.
Who would conduct such a public hearing?
I don't know. I don't know who is Representative Devlin.
Well, I'm just referring to your comments about that if the legislature was displeased, you'd take notice of it. You'd probably take notice of it if the governor was displeased with me.
We certainly are. Okay. Mr. Chair, that's
okay.
Either one of those constituents would be the case. Very clear notice.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you very much. And I didn't see any need. Sure. Edwards has asked, he has a constituent who wanted to drive down and testify, asked to hold the work session open on this till 3:50 or so when his constituent could arrive. And we'll go and I've agreed to give him that courtesy. So we will suspend the work session and then we'll come back to it on Senate Bill 229.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to make our scheduled start cooking burgers in about 10 minutes.
About 10 minutes.
Well?
I think we're a little bit of a fair amount of support. We will suspend the discussion on Senate Bill 229 and go to Senate Bill 937 and open the work session with invited testimony today. Because this is a fairly complex issue, and I wanted to have some testimony come in to kind of brief us, to give us an opportunity to develop some comfort level with the bill. I'd like to call Jim Gardner, Ted Falk, and Jim Mattis, and Bob Kohler forward to provide us with some information. And while you're coming, would you give us an overview of the bill as it currently stands?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 937, A in growth, modifies laws that relate to genetic privacy. The bill specifies that genetic information and DNA samples are not the property of an individual. It specifies that genetic information and DNA samples are private and must be protected. It specifies encryption and coding and disclosure processes to achieve. The bill also specifies that it authorizes action under unlawful trade practices laws for violations of genetic privacy law. There is an emergency clause on the bill, and it takes effect on pass. The bill passed the Senate 16-11, and it's non-fiscal and non-revenue. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. I believe you're aware we asked for about a half an hour of overview on the bill and the issue and where we're at today. And I appreciate you taking the time out of your life to come down here and visit with us today. So introduce yourself to the record one at a time, please, and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm represent Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. And at Senate Bill 937 was our bill, is our bill, but it became the vehicle for the consolidating effort that you're going to hear a little bit about today. So why don't I just briefly, if I could, Mr. Chair, give a little bit of background on this, and then I believe Jeanette's relationship with Ted Falk from OGPAC will provide a more broader introduction. Pharma is the National Trade Association for Jim Gardner representing Pharma. Pharma, Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. Pharma includes in its membership approximately 100 major drug manufacturers that discover, manufacture, and market the majority of pharmaceutical products made in America and sold in America. We became involved in this bill and sought the introduction of this for a couple of reasons. And I passed out something that you have in front of you here, which is, tells you a little bit about why we got involved. This is a publication by the Business Journal called the 1999 Oregon Bioscience and Medical Technology Directory. And when you thumb through this, you will see that there is a great deal of interest in Oregon in biotechnology, bioscience as a vital new source of jobs, a new industry that could become a very valuable player in the future in the Oregon economy. There was, however, and I should also say that that typically the investments for biotechnology companies comes from our industry, not from traditional venture capital, just because we partner with these young companies, these small companies, to try to get them started, because we think they often have an entrepreneurial approach that can be very valuable. But there was a big problem with Oregon, and it was an inadvertent problem that came with the initial passage of Oregon's pioneering genetic privacy law in 1995. And that was that the way that Oregon chose to protect genetic privacy, which we all agree is extremely important, was to give a person a property interest in his or her genome. Now, that sounds logical, and it certainly seemed at the time unobjectionable. But the problem was that there are two problems, basically, with that. From the point of view of protecting an individual's privacy, it's not a good approach, because if it's property, then just like an acre of land or a house, it can be sold. It can be transferred away. And in fact, we discovered that is happening in Oregon. It's an alienable right as opposed to a right like your free speech rights or equal protection, which are inalienable rights. So we thought that was a problem. But second, from a business perspective, that provision created what amounted to a cloud on title. It would be as if you had built a house and you had an undisclosed plumber's lien, or in the case of Representative Gardner's profession, undisclosed electrician's lien that was out there that created a type of intellectual property risk that wasn't present in other states where our companies invest and do business. So, to make a long story short, we met for, I think, the three of us plus Bruce Bishop from Kaiser met for days in these long sessions to try to craft what is became Senate Bill 937. The bill was aimed at dealing with these issues, and in lieu of the property approach to protecting genetic privacy, we used the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which is the provision that's used for many protection purposes in Oregon right now, lending policies, those kinds of things. We thought we had a pretty good product. The bill came out of Senate Judiciary with only one dissenting vote. Senator Courtney, good bipartisan support, We had on that committee not only every Republican voting for it, but Kate Brown and Jenny Burdick as well. And then a funny thing happened to us on the way to the statute books. On the day that the bill was up for vote on the Senate floor, a letter from the governor was delivered expressing concern and misgivings about it. The four votes fell to 16, and we have been struggling ever since to come up with some changes that will assuage the concerns, but not in the same time destroy the bill. From our perspective, Senate Bill 937A in growth as it exists is great, but that's not the perspective of the governor's office, and it is not the perspective of, at this point, of some of the other participants. So I will tell you that we have struggled mightily with this. We continue to struggle with it, and we hope to come back with some progress that we can report directly to you.
And your work group meetings are ongoing.
They're ongoing, and we're struggling mightily.
Will you be able to come to closure before our session comes to closure?
We're going
to
try. I can't promise anything, Chair Simmons, but we're really, and I think that all of us would agree that we have. I've spent personally more time on this bill than I've ever spent on any piece of legislation in my career, it, both as a member and as a lobbyist. So it's a very complex area, and it's right at the interface of scientific progress and law.
I do expect Lexington to definitely address this next session, probably the session after that. As science progresses, it does change the parameters of what we can lay out here. So.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ted Falk, and I'm here today representing a group called Oregon Genetic Privacy Advisory Committee, and I was also one of the original drafters of the legislation in 1995. And rather than getting you mired down in some of the rather particular issues that Mr. Gardner was referring to that are currently being discussed, I thought it would be helpful for those members of your committee that aren't familiar with this law at all to have a little background on how it came into being in 1995. I've handed out two pieces of written testimony. One is called an analysis of genetic privacy bill, which is kind of a backgrounder on what the bill is and how it came into being. And then the other one, which I'll return to in a moment, is called OGCAT. That's the Oregon Genetic Privacy Advisory Committee positions on Senate Bill 937. So before I turn to my the particulars of 937, let's talk about what the law is. In 1994, the Multnomah County Medical Society convened a work group to examine what were what a number of experts in the healthcare field thought were the most pressing issues of medical privacy, and that work group determined that genetic privacy was the most pressing issue that Oregon did not currently address in any sort of legal form. And by genetic privacy, we mean the privacy that is afforded to either an individual's biological samples, which are used for genetic testing, or to the information that could be derived from a genetic test. That work group, which I was a part of, and former Senator Shoemaker was a part of, met as long and hard as Jim Gardner has described our recent group has met, and we came up with legislation which was enacted in 1995. Oregon was really the first state in the country to adopt a comprehensive genetic privacy bill. Many other states have subsequently followed, and Oregon's law is viewed as a pioneering law and a leading law, which is quite honestly why organizations like PhRMA, I think, pay so much attention to it, because we are viewed as a trendsetter in this particular area. The 1995 law protects genetic privacy in three dimensions. First of all, it protects when the information or sample is obtained from the individual. That would most typically be in a medical office. Secondly, it protects you when information is retained for or stored. That would frequently be in a
storage bank of a medical laboratory or a medical institution. And then finally, it protects you when information is disclosed. And it's really at the moment of disclosure that the greatest potential of harm to the individual can occur. Individuals can and have lost employment or insurability and suffered other sorts of consequences when genetic information about them was revealed. And the reason why it was seen necessary to address genetic information in the statute book separately from other medical information is that it has such tremendous power to protect, to project the future of an individual's medical history. Most medical records only tell you what happened to you in the past. Genetic information is uniquely capable of projecting what is going to happen to you in the future, and that is why it has this special law. So this special law has been on the books since 1995. It is working. The problems that have come up subsequently to the law mainly relate to the impact that it has had on research, and I think everybody acknowledges that those are valid issues and ought to be dealt with. The first attempt to deal with those issues occurred in 1997. There was an amendment to the law that was passed that created an exception for what the law refers to as anonymous research. That's research done in which no individual identification can be associated with a genetic sample or the information. So if there's no possibility of identifying an individual, the ethical issues are non-existent or minimized, and so that exception was built in 1997. Unfortunately, the drafters of the 1997 legislature, I don't think, realized how complicated the sort of research projects are, and so we are back before this legislative body now to try to deal with additional research issues. Now, to try to summarize in a nutshell what 937 does, I have a three-page piece of testimony called Odds, Tax Positions on Senate Bill 937. The last page of that testimony has the heading Consensus Elements of Genetic Privacy, dated 4/29/99, and substantially these principles were presented to the Senate Judiciary Committee as explaining the essential features that 937 tried to address. And those were fivefold. First of all, that the property rights approach to protection of genetic privacy that Mr. Gardner has referred to can be replaced by direct protection of genetic privacy. Number two, that the teeth for that protection would be the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Number three, that the federal, what is referred to as the common rule, which is the federal law governing biomedical research, would be appropriate to govern the use of genetic information for non-anonymous research. The fourth, anonymous research would be expanded to include coded or encrypted research. And then fifth, for purposes of medical diagnosis, a blood relative would have access to a sample from a deceased individual. So these, in essence, were five principles which don't look terribly complicated, which gave rise to 937. Unfortunately, in this sort of area, which is very technical both from the biological standpoint and the legal standpoint, a lot of the differences arise in how those principles are interpreted when you get down to particular legal issues. And now, if I could turn to my own organization's position on 937, we did support these five principles. We continue to support these five principles, which would mean essentially that there is some bill in the neighborhood of 937 that we would support, but we do have some reservations about the final language that was adopted. I don't think it would probably be fruitful to go through those particular areas with the committee at this point because they're kind of technical, although I'll be happy to address anything that you want to. But suffice to say that we've been passing drafts back and forth among different parties and have yet to come up with a single draft that can satisfy everyone. I don't think there is a lot of disagreement at the level of principle on this bill, but unfortunately we have not yet found a way to translate it into practice. It is my hope that with another week or two of work, we might be able to come up with a consensus bill.
Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the issues relative to disclosure of genetic information that you've highlighted on is the particular damage that could occur to an individual if that information was disclosed to individuals or entities without that person's permission. One of the difficulties along with this information that's confidential like that is once the information is so secret, out of the bag, it's out.
Correct.
I mean, once you have an unauthorized release and you no longer have control of the information, it literally can almost end up in anyone's hands. One of the things I want the committee to answer, maybe not today, but maybe when we bring it back, for the groups who are working on this, most of the consumer groups that I deal with on issues don't consider the unauthorized practices act a particularly strong tool in terms of dealing with consumer issues. And I just want to, and I'll do some more checking just to see what the potential penalties are, but I don't know what the deterrence effect of that really is, and whether or not you might want to consider more significant penalties that might have a more significant deterrence impact.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, that's a very good question. We have been struggling to find the best framework for the remedy for the injured consumer, and certainly the Unlawful Trade Practices Act has its problems. But, and so I wouldn't say that that's the uniquely best solution, but the reasons why we chose that solution are, first of all, it does have a provision for attorney's fees and minimum statutory damages, and second of all, perhaps particularly important in this area, does provide for attorney general enforcement. This is an area where many average people would not even understand the significance of an injury to them, and it does take some sort of state official to at least potentially have some sort of enforcement authority. But I think you also raise another valid point, which is legislation in this area should be effectuated by the companies, the industries, the healthcare providers, medical laboratories, the research companies themselves. We should not be thinking this primarily as a system of legal remedies enforcement. We should primarily be thinking of this as a set of guidelines and rules that people in the healthcare industry will follow. But the issue of what is an adequate remedy is of great concern to us, and we're certainly open to any suggestions people can come up with as to the best remedy. The original property framework that Mr. Gardner described was essentially supposed to be a shorthand description of a remedy for the injured consumer, but we come to the conclusion that that remedy wouldn't be very well understood by a consumer who wanted to use it.
Let me also quickly, way back when in the one of the first iterations, we put forward a slightly different approach to an enforcement scheme, which was essentially a fixed fine that were pretty steep plus provisions for injunctive relief. So that was another take on how to get at the teeth problem.
Mr. Chairman, I just have in terms of, you know, trying to prove what your compensable damages were, whether or not the person had intent in terms of their punitive damages, passively working with consumer groups and trying to get certain district attorneys to actually file cases and white-collar crime issues when they have other criminal activities that they're focusing on. It just many times doesn't seem like a particularly viable deterrent. And my mind could be changed. I'll talk to the Attorney General to see how he feels about it. But I know he's always fighting for more resources for his consumer protection division. He usually doesn't get very much of what he's fighting for. So.
Chairman Simmons, members of the committee, I'm Jim Mattis, and I'm in the Oregon Health Sciences University Legal Department. I'm here representing OHSU along with Dr. Kohler, who I would like to invite up to primarily give you as best as we can understanding of, at least in part, why we're here. OHSU has felt like for at least the last 13, about 16 months, that it's been trying to pull teeth to get various parties two of whom are on both sides of me now, but others as well that are not at this table, to try to come together in order, from the institution's perspective, to try to seek a broader definition of what type of research can legitimately go on in order for valuable research that promotes health to occur, as opposed to the current version of the law. Ted Falk has already identified for you that this legislature wrestled with this issue in part in 97, as it provided definition of anonymous. I would point to you the very first section of Section 1, which 937 in its current form would delete, and the definition of anonymous research. And the key point there is that it is such research that where the identity of a person from whom genetic information has
the Apex City Commission suggested a moratorium on all expansion of gambling, and this would certainly fall under that. So I strongly urge you, on behalf of Stop Winning Gambling Addiction, Greg DeFlorio, Lloyd Marbet, on behalf of the senators who voted against this bill in the Senate across party lines, the bill very narrowly passed. The initial vote had 15 votes, and the 16th vote was found, including Senator Starr, Senator Gordy, Senator Nelson, Senator Lynn, Senator Shannon, Senator Q-Tub, Senator Shields, definitely a bunch that don't always agree. So I would ask you on their behalf to please vote against this bill, and with that I will take any questions you might have.
Yeah,
thank you, Mr. for being here. You missed some testimony earlier, which described that the Oregon Racing Commission actually passed a resolution, I believe, last Friday with testimony, saying that, that they would only allow up to 25 off-track carts, from the current 20. My assumption is I wouldn't change your opinion about the bill.
First of all, thank you for allowing me to be here today as well. That would not change my position against the bill. First of all, Senate Bill 229 repeals the current simulcasting statutes from start to finish and puts Senate Bill 229 in its place. And Senate Bill 229 is intended throughout its entirety to expand simulcasting. It allows them to simulcast year-round at the track, at the two local tracks. It allows them to set up your own betting networks. Additionally, the limit of 20 simulcast locations is not the only rule or regulation that is being repealed. Another one which is being repealed, which I'm curious no one has discussed, is a rule which says that you cannot have a simulcasting operation with the exception of simulcasting parlors in the metropolitan area within 50 miles of a live horse race without their written permission. That's another rule, for example, is being repealed. So what we're really doing here is rewriting the simulcast laws from start to finish. The original limit on simulcasting parlors was 10. That limit was reached. They listed it to 15. That limit was reached. They listed it to 20. That limit was reached. If their position is they wanted to simply expand it to only 25, our response would be that this is an expansion of gambling. This is a change in the simulcasting laws with the intent of pushing gambling as far as they can. They may not be able to go over 25 right now, and they may come next session like they have the previous sessions will say, well, we're at 25 this time, we simply need to bump it to 30. These parlors are magnets for gambling. Carlos showed another one. The Rialto in downtown Portland is one example. They have the video poker machines there, and they have the simulcasting. Obviously, they have drinks and that type of thing. And this is really something that's in the community. The Greyhound Protection League and working on this issue in several other states did studies that proved that when simulcasting parlors went into the neighborhood, the crime rate rose. So this is simply an expansion of gambling that would not change our traditional standards.
Further questions from Mr. Teal? Thank you, Terry, for diving down on such short notice.
Thank you very much, Mr. Teal.
Yes, sure. Sure, and
Senate Bill 2904 to be passed recommendation.
A and gross version.
S1. Have a motion for us to move the A and gross version of Senate Bill 2904 to be passed recommendation. Any discussion? Mr. Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No secret that I'm not a big fan of gambling in this state. So my target has mostly been the state-sponsored gambling that we have in the form of a video lottery. I don't have a huge issue with horse racing and dog racing in the state. I'll be supporting them. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I share the concern, and I think looking at the resolution the Commission put forward and passed, that it does, in my mind, give me enough comfort to support this bill. I think Mr. Teal does raise an issue that we always need to look at, which is how far we're going to keep going down the gambling path. And again, the resolution even recognizes that there's a legitimate concern of Sandy by the governor, the legislature, and the commission about the expansion of gambling in the state. So, I mean, I think that's always important for us when we vote on things like this, to keep in mind where we're heading with this state. And I tend to agree with a good friend from I do think there is. I too have been concerned about how far we're going. I think it was a straight and safe conversation for me. And I think we continually need to re examine how far we're looking down that path. But that isn't really reflecting before it, too. I'll support it.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin.
I would concur with the comments of both of my colleagues. I've been particularly concerned about video poker. But I'm not particularly concerned about this bill. And also, I look at it from the standpoint of when it hasn't been overly stated jurisdiction. It's actually going in the Racing Commission, as I understand it, more than they've had previously, which I think is good.
Bill goes to 4, the bill passed recommendation, the volunteer for carrier. And the big jump at once.
Selfish.
Okay. I'll be the carrier. And, and we'll focus on the House of 70. And we're going to a work session on House of 2830. We did a little project the other day to reconsider a vote on that bill. I believe, if memory serves me correctly, there are a lot of bills before us this place. This morning, reconsider our vote, which we passed out to House Bill 2830 and brought it back into our possession, pending arrival of a new set of amendments in that bill.
And those amendments are being passed by the Mr. Chair, -6A-7. And the possibility is to issue some changes to the -6 amendment.
Commissioner Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. With me today is Director DeLuca of Oregon OSHA. For the record, I'm still representing Jeff Krupp, District 37. And yes, we do, in fact, have some more amendments for you that we think will make it a better bill that everyone is a lot more comfortable with. Essentially, what we do here with the Dash 6s is make some technical word changes. In the first part, we need to conceptually amend the Dash 6s in a couple of areas, and I'd like to draw your attention to the first page, line number 12. And I apologize to your committee administrator. I forgot to show this information to him a moment ago. We want to scratch out the word lost workday cases incident. We want to scratch those words out. We want to add the words accepted disabling claims.
Can you repeat that? What line are you
on? We're on line number 12 of the first page of the Dash 6s. We want to delete lost workday cases incident and replace it with accepted disabling claims. And Director DeLuca will speak more fully to this in a moment. And we want to replace the word national with state. That's the last word in that sentence. The rest of from line 11 down through line 21 is essentially inserting language that deals with a couple of issues, and one of them, the issue of random inspections. And there was some concern that we were in effect deleting random inspections by our previous language. That was not our intent, and so what we worked out with the director is language here that allows random inspection to continue pursuant to written neutral administrative standards.
Okay, that would be on line 18?
Yes. So we're fine until we get down to line 24 at the bottom of the page. The last three words at the beginning we want to eliminate conceptually, and we want to eliminate line 1 through line 5 on the second page.
Lines 1 through 5, all of that.
Right. Now, let me explain this to you. This still wasn't the wording quite that I was looking for from legislative counsel. In my discussions with various union members outside the chamber or the hearing room here earlier in this day, they were not aware of the language that the OSHA Field Inspection Reference Manual actually states. They were still uncomfortable with that, and they brought up an excellent point to me that they felt that language might be inconsistent with the current statute. So that's a red flag to me, and what I need to do is go to legislative counsel and get an opinion from them for my own good understanding. And probably we've worked out with them, with the director, that we will kind of work on this issue during the interim time period. I still have feelings about conceptually that during the interview process there are certain employee rights that need to be accorded, and we're going to work on that with the unions and the director to try to come to some understanding. We also need to understand is that the agency currently is under a permanent injunction that they have appealed, and that appeal will be heard the 1st of July, and at some point in time through the summer we'll have a rendering of a judicial opinion about that permanent injunction. And it has to do with this field inspection manual and the policy. So what we're going to do is kind of work on that in the interim time period and let that issue rest for now until we have a better sense of where that's headed in the courts. And as you continue down page number 2, we delete all the references to during the interview process. Basically, we just restore all of the original language that's in the current statute. And then we also want to add in the Dash 7 amendments, which essentially delete some additional language in the original bill that we had added at the very end of the bill. which Director DeLuca and I are working on a further amendment that we'll put in on the Senate side there, and that really has to do with an attorney being represented as an employer representative during certain processes, and the agency has been uncomfortable with our language, and so they've given us some language that we think is probably very workable. That's a very minor part of the bill, but it was something we wanted to be sure to address on the agency's part. But the Dash 7 basically keep all of the original language from the current statute and take all of our language out of the bill that we had in there originally. And then we'll go ahead and pursue this later on the Senate side with that particular issue. But I think we've managed to allay most everyone's concerns here.
Just one quick question. In the Dash 7, you're taking out all the references for attorney?
Yeah, all of the bolded material in the original bill in Section 5 is gone, and the bracketed material is restored.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I don't have a question, but just a comment. I'd just like to really applaud your efforts of working on a consensus bill. You know, certainly come a long way, and with those changes, I think I can withdraw all my objections previously.
And Mr. DeLuca, did you want to comment on these amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record. Peter DeLuca, the Administrator of Oregon. I'm sorry, I'm not the Director.
My apologies, sir.
Well, I'll accept the much offer it. In terms of substituting accepted disabling claims rate as opposed to the lost work day case incident rate, we have access to the accepted disabling claims rate, but we don't have access to the lost workday case incident rate. And so I pointed out to Representative Krupp that if we had that in the bill, then we wouldn't be able to comply simply because we don't have access to that information. And that's why we've made that substitution. And the same reason with replacing the word national and going to state.
In terms of what's in
the point of clarification on that conceptual amendment, accepted disabling claims. When we say accepted, can you describe what we're talking about?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, an accepted disabling claim is a claim which has been accepted by the system as having a disabling impact, and it keeps the employee off the job for 3 days or more. That's the information that we do have access to. Lost workday case incident rate is based upon the number of employees in a place of employment and the number of those employees who lost the second day of work after the first day. If you were injured today, excuse me, and then missed the following day's work, that would be a lost workday case. So that's the difference between the two. Either way, what you end up with is an index of which employers are having the most serious and the most numerous serious accidents in their workplaces. In terms of the private interview, the Dash 6 has deleted that, and certainly that's something that we had asked for. It's pretty complicated stuff, but there is an injunction that's involved in the whole thing, and I don't know if you want me to go into that or not. Because I glaze over.
That's good. I'll just put it in this, if you'd like to go into the injunction and legal background there.
I think we'd go for not, Mr. Chair.
That was my initial thought.
In terms of notification of employers who do have accepted disabling claims above the state average, I think we need to work a little bit on language which would provide us with clear direction as to how we're going to notify. My preference would be, frankly, regular mail for the last known address. Also with the proviso that there's if we fail to notify somebody it doesn't have any impact on any citation that we might otherwise issue at some later date. But I think we're pretty well close on that.
Now, Mr. Chair, for the record, let me state that our intention has never been if the notification issue and offering of consultative services, the intention has never been to allow an employer the out because he didn't get a notification in the mail that he may be infected. You should never have them use that as an opportunity to disallow an inspection. That was never our intention, and I'm very comfortable with adding language in on the Senate side to clarify that for the director's concerns.
We could even look at the possibility of adding or doing that to administrative rulemaking, and that's a possibility as well.
And in terms of the Dash 7 amendments that have to do with right to counsel, the concern was that, as written, that particular provision would have elevated the right to counsel in our OSHA enforcement actions to a level far above that of a criminal suspect in a criminal case. And I don't know if that was ever the intent, but that was the effect, and that was what the problem was. And I think by doing what we've done here, we've eliminated that problem as well. Frankly, I haven't seen all of this tied together, and I've seen only the Dash 6 for a very brief period of time, but conceptually this sounds like we're getting very close to what we need in order to have a bill that's going to help us all. Good. It's going to be a unanimous consensus essentially rules in order to conceptually amend the Dash 6.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a procedural question. We have adopted previous amendments. Not having seen all of this pieced together, do we have to remove those previous amendments? Or
that's what may be beneficial if we do.
You go back to the original bill and then add amendments?
It's been pressing me after that first.
Mr. Chair, The Dash 6s are not legislative council asked me the question as to whether I wanted the Dash 6s to be incorporated with the Dash 5, which was essentially a compilation of the 1, 2, 3, and 4s. And I didn't think that was necessary. I can see now, based on that concern, that perhaps that was an error. And
I think compared to the two amendments, it may be appropriate to remove the Dash 5 and then stick in the Dash 6 and 7. Mm-hmm.
Let
me look at the Dash 5.
I do have at least a few rules for purposes of conceptual amendments.
Why don't we remove the
Dash 5
first, and then
do we have the bill in front of us?
Yes, we do. We have the bill in front of us. Do you have the bill in front of us?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, earlier,
later, absolutely.
You didn't have to
do it for us. It didn't go off.
And then drop the address, and we reconsidered the vote and put it back in the recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we reconsider the vote by which we adopted the Dash 5 amendment for 28-3.
Mr. Chair, I would say after reviewing the Dash 5, I think that's an appropriate course of action. I'll review them further, but I don't, there's a cursory inspection here. I don't see anything in the Dash 5 that we don't replace essentially here with the 6s and the 7s. So that would be fine with me.
Okay. And just for clarification, Mr. Chair, the Dash 5 were the only amendments that we adopted?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's why the only ones that we adopted. There was a motion for us to reconsider the vote by which we adopted the Dash 5. Is there any objection? Any discussion on that motion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, move for unanimous consent to conceptually amend.
We need to reconsider the vote. Now we need to actually remove the
Okay.
Vote.
Okay.
Remove the amendment?
Yeah, move
the
chair.
That's not going to double tone it. No.
If you reconsider the vote on the Dash 5,
that means we never took the vote on the Dash 5.
Yeah. We did take the vote and put them in.
We reconsidered that vote, so that means we did not take that vote.
not need to vote for taking them out.
No need to vote for taking them out. Well, we have Senate rules for purposes of reconsidering that. I mean, that's
the problem. The power of the end of
it. We voted to reconsider another reconsideration spending, then we can adopt or disadopt.
Yeah, we can either adopt or take it out. We have that option before us now.
Mr. Chair, I move that we remove the Dash 5 amendments from the bill.
Okay. Is there a motion before us that we remove the Dash 5 amendments before the bill? That are in the bill, we put in a week or so ago, that would be House Bill 2830. Is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, so order. Mr. Chair, I'd move, do we need to adopt the Dash 6 before we amend, or should we?
I would suggest that we conceptually amend the amendment before we adopt it into the bill.
I would move for suspension of the rule for the purposes of conceptually amending the Dash 6.
Because there are a motion before us to suspend the rules for purposes of conceptually amending the Dash 6 amendment, House Bill 2830. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to conceptually amend the Dash 6 amendment as follows. On line 12, remove the words loss, work, day, case, incident, and insert accepted disabling claim. On the same line, remove the last word on the line 12, national, and insert the word state. On line 24, remove the last three words on the line at the beginning. And on page 2, lines 1 through 5, remove it in its entirety.
Okay. Just one question while we do this. That's accurate, as you stated it. You want to delete the word privacy on line 24.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Yes. And you have to create insert. That language, you want to leave that there?
Actually, you could delete all the language. You could delete the word and after the period insert, you could delete all of that. Would be fine.
I believe that's what I said, Mr. Chair. And just insert a period afterward. That would be fine.
A period would be fine.
We are, with the Gardner's ruling that we, on line 24, insert a period afterward privacy, delete the rest of the line. And then lines 1 through 5 on page 2 of your desk, just an amendment. Okay, colleagues, any discussion on that motion? Any objection to that motion? Hearing none, so order.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 6 amendment as conceptually amended.
Okay, calling for the motion before us to move the Dash 6 amendment as conceptually amended into the bill. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The Dash 6 amendment as conceptually amended are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Dash 7 amendment.
Three colleagues, there are a motion to adopt the Dash 7 amendment, House Bill 2830. Is there any discussion on that motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, so
ordered. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2830 as amended before the due pass recommendation.
Okay, colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be honored to carry this bill to the floor, and I do appreciate the committee's indulgence and patience.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I believe we did have one other bill posted before us today. We do have an amendment for the bill that is prepared to sort of make the bill into a referral, and we've been asked to there's some discussion about when this would go out and such it needs to resolve, and we just look at the speaker once again before the part that amendment into the bill.
100% idea.
And so we will have to hold it until hopefully tomorrow we'll be back to it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
We'll come back to this. Do we need if it's two-thirds of the unanimous vote of the reconceptual amendment?
Yes. taking the one that can't for conceptual amendments to make it roll it back to 1%.
Sure, Jared. Two-thirds vote for conceptual amendments.
Okay.
I just want to agree with Representative Byer. You need a two-thirds vote. If you get unanimous consent, it's quick. If not, you need a motion and two-thirds, which in this case would be four members, would have to vote. There's five here.
So if you want to, you put in a conceptual amendment to reduce the capital gains tax rate from four as indicated in the bill down the warrant, we'll need a four vote maybe on that for that two-thirds vote if you want to do that.
Okay, number five. Hey, I don't want to get extra work. Now, we do have our committee function this evening. I know some of you do have other business to attend. I hope you will at least be able to drop by. Nice to have you there for a while.
Can we get, Mr. Chairman, can we get one clarification for tomorrow? Will we be meeting at 8 o'clock tomorrow?
I think we won't need 8 o'clock tomorrow until Mr. Moore and I get the schedules all worked out. We will meet there at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. So a little bit short notice on that right now anyway, so. You are adjourned.
Yes, we are adjourned.
So it's me, you are adjourned.
Mm-hmm.